Good morning, Mendocino. This is Jeff Blankford. Welcome you to the December 26th edition of Takes on the World, a public affairs program that comes your way the second and fourth Wednesdays of every month, and every other fifth Wednesday when I open the phones to you, our listeners. For those of you who celebrated Christmas yesterday, I hope it was enjoyable, and for those who did something else, I hope it was equally enjoyable. I don't expect you to feel the same way about today's program, which is more on the educational side. It was pre-recorded for playing at this time, but not exactly for your listening pleasure. What you will hear are two typically ugly examples of Washington's deference to Israel and its American supporters, recorded November 30th and largely ignored by the mainstream media, which has its own problems in reporting truthfully about America's Middle East partner. They came the day after the UN General Assembly voted 138-9 with 41 abstentions to make Palestine a non-member state in the world body, and the day that Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu declared, to punish the Palestinians for going to the UN, that he was authorizing the building of 3,000 more Jewish-only housing units in Palestine, East Jerusalem, including in the E1 corridor, which will effectively end the possibility of a Palestinian state in the West Bank. The move by Netanyahu so angered Britain and France that they recalled their ambassadors from Israel, and while other European countries also strongly criticized the Israeli move. The White House, however, while expressing unhappiness with Netanyahu's announcement, did not directly condemn it, as it did the Palestinian decision to go to the UN. That's the essential background for what you will hear this morning. First on tap is a half-hour speech by Secretary of State Hillary Clinton to the Saban Forum, an annual dinner hosted by billionaire Israeli-American communications tycoon Haim Saban. Saban is not only one of the Democratic Party's major funders, he also has given $10 million to Bill Clinton's library and foundation since the president left office, and supported Hillary in her 2008 campaign for the White House, where Saban and his wife Cheryl were treated to a few sleepovers when Bill was president. In March of 2008, Saban was among a group of major Jewish donors to sign a letter to Democratic Party House Leader Nancy Pelosi, warning her to, quote, keep out of the Democratic Party presidential primaries, end quote. The donors, who were, quote, were strong supporters of Senator Clinton's presidential campaign, end quote, were incensed by an interview in which Pelosi said that party superdelegates should heed the will of the majority in selecting a candidate. The letter to Pelosi stated the donors, quote, have been strong supporters of the DCCC, the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, and implied, according to the Jewish Telegraphic Agency, that Pelosi could lose their financial support in important upcoming congressional elections. At a conference in Israel in 2009, Saban described his formula, his, quote, three ways to be influential in American politics, end quote, he said, were to make donations to political parties, establish think tanks, and control media outlets. In 2002, the year that he founded the Saban Center for Middle East at the Brookings Institution, he contributed $7 million toward the cost of a new building for the Democratic National Committee in Washington, D.C., one of the largest known donations ever made to an American political party. The same year, he considered buying the New Republic, but decided it wasn't for him, and Time and Newsweek weren't available. Earlier this year, he reportedly tried to buy Al Jazeera. Saban and his private equity partners acquired Univision, the largest Spanish TV network, in 2007. He has made repeated bids for the LA Times, which is near his home in Beverly Hills. Saban Forum is the yearly main event of the Saban Center of the Brookings Institution, a once-respected capital think tank that Saban essentially bought for between $12 and $13 million in 2002, turning it into another influential Israeli propaganda outpost, one of several that dominate the Washington, D.C. political landscape. Clinton's presentation will be followed by excerpts from a State Department press conference that morning in which her press spokesperson, Victoria Nuland, fought off questions from the media regarding both events, the Palestinian gaining statehood recognition from the UN and Netanyahu's announcement of additional new housing units. In that one, one American reporter, Matt Lee from the Associated Press, asked many questions, good questions. The others asking questions represent foreign media. One curious thing you should know about Victoria Nuland, according to the Post by Clinton, and likely to accompany the secretary should she win the White House in 2016, Nuland is the wife of neocon Robert Kagan. Robert Kagan, one of the founders of the Project for a New American Century. Madam Clinton's speech was preceded by a video showing a variety of Israeli government officials, past and present, expressing their undying admiration for the secretary, leading the New Yorker's David Remnick to describe the event as the first in her campaign for the White House in 2016. Not only does the curtain behind her carry the logo of the Saban Forum in English and Hebrew, the entire event appeared to have been largely a love affair for Israel. And here she is.
I prepared some remarks for tonight, but then I thought maybe we could just watch that video a few more times. And then the next time I could count the hairstyles, which, you know, is one of my favorite pastimes. I think I now know what it feels like to be one of Haim's Mighty Morphin Power Rangers. Well, I guess we should expect nothing less from Haim Saban, who's a friend, a colleague, a mentor, an inspiration to so many of us here tonight. He certainly has always challenged me to make the most of America's place in the world, and especially our close friendship with Israel. And it is extremely humbling to be honored by the Saban Forum in front of so many Americans and Israelis whom I know and respect so greatly, and I am so appreciative of all those very much too kind words. I can't wait to show my husband. And speaking of spouses, I want to acknowledge my dear friend, Cheryl Saban, who's been doing heroic work as a public delegate with our team at the United Nations. There are so many friends here, and it's always a little dangerous, in fact, a lot dangerous, to acknowledge or point out any, but obviously I want to thank Martin Indyk and Tamara Wittes and all the thinkers and scholars whose insights help us navigate this very difficult, challenging time. I also want to say a special word to two friends who are retiring. One, Senator Joe Lieberman, who is who is leaving the Senate and going into stand-up comedy, I'm told. He's got a lot of good lines. I've heard many of them over the years. But he and Hadassah deserve some very well-merited time for themselves. And, of course, Ehud Barak, who's announced his retirement. And so we want to wish you very much happiness in the future as well. Let me also acknowledge the chairman of my authorizing and oversight committee, Senator John Kerry. Thank you, John. And Teresa Hines, it's wonderful seeing you here as well. My Congresswoman, Nita Lowy, who does such a great job in every way and is, as they say, moving on up, which we're happy to hear. I saw Howard Berman here, and I think we all want to pay a great acknowledgement and gratitude to Howard. There are some others that I just want briefly to mention, other members of Congress. I know there are some here, but I can't see everyone. I want to also acknowledge Foreign Minister Lieberman, Deputy Prime Minister Meridor, Ambassador Oren, our Ambassador Dan Shapiro, my former Deputy Secretary, Jim Steinberg, everyone who's made this journey to be with us tonight. And I think that we have a lot to celebrate because for years we have told you, our Israeli friends, that America has Israel's back, and this month we proved it again. When Israel responded to a rain of rockets, when sirens sounded and schools emptied and air raid shelters filled, America's next move was never in question. President Obama and I stood before the international community and supported Israel's right to defend itself from a threat no country would tolerate. The Iron Dome system, invented by Israel, underwritten by America, knocked rockets out of the sky like never before. We supported regional and international efforts to de-escalate the conflict and then seized on a diplomatic opening when it came. Working closely with President Obama from halfway around the world, I left the East Asia Summit in Cambodia to fly to Tel Aviv, to drive to Jerusalem, to meet with the Prime Minister and members of the inner cabinet, to go the next day to Ramallah, then back to the Prime Minister's office, and then to Cairo. And we were able to play a role in enabling the ceasefire to occur. That fragile ceasefire is holding. The skies above Israel are clear. And we are beginning to see the efforts to rebuild and resume daily life. But the world knows, and always will know, that whenever Israel is threatened, the United States will be there. Now, that's a good thing, because we believe in our shared values. We understand we both live in a complicated and dangerous world. We're in the midst of a transformative moment in the Middle East. One that offers as many questions, in fact, more questions than answers, and one that poses new challenges to Israel's place in the emerging regional order. As the story unfolds, all of us must work together to seize the promise and meet these challenges of this dynamic, changing Middle East. In the past month alone, we've seen both the promise and those challenges. We've seen post-revolutionary Egypt work with the United States to help Israel broker a ceasefire and protect Egypt's peace treaty with Israel. We have seen cutting-edge defenses protect Israel, cities and rural areas. We have seen Israel fight for and win a stop to rocket fire from Gaza. But we've also seen the challenge of turning a ceasefire into a lasting calm, of helping Palestinians committed to peace find a more constructive path to pursue it, of putting Israel's peace with Egypt on a stronger foundation, of making sure that Iran can never acquire a nuclear weapon. And just yesterday, as you know, the United Nations General Assembly voted to grant the Palestinian Authority non-member observer state status, a step that will not bring us any closer to peace. When it comes to a region full of uncertainty, upheaval, revolution, this much is constant and clear. America and Israel are in it together. This is a friendship that comes naturally to us. Americans honor Israel as a homeland dreamed of for generations and finally achieved by pioneering men and women in my lifetime. We share bedrock beliefs in freedom, equality, democracy, and the right to live without fear. What threatens Israel threatens America, and what strengthens Israel strengthens us. Our two governments maintain not just the formal U.S.-Israel strategic dialogue, but a daily dialogue, sometimes an hourly dialogue, at every level. In a season of tight budgets, U.S. assistance to Israel is at a record high. And over the past few weeks, I have heard from Israelis the gratitude they felt when, after hearing the sirens, they saw a second rocket launch and knew that was Iron Dome making them safer. America has helped keep Israel's qualitative military edge as strong as ever. And Prime Minister Netanyahu has described our security cooperation and overall partnership with Israel as unprecedented. Our shared obsession with innovation is also bringing us closer together. Google Executive Chairman Eric Schmidt recently called Israel the most important high-tech center in the world after the United States. So it is no surprise that our diplomatic challenge is not only about a dialogue of strategic and political interests, including not just our soldiers and our politicians, but increasingly including our techies and our venture capitalists and our entrepreneurs. And it's no surprise that since Israel signed America's first ever free trade agreement back in 1985, trade between us has increased from $5 billion to more than $35 billion. But all that we hope to accomplish together depends on keeping Israelis safe to pursue their passions in peace and security. It depends on ensuring Israel's future as a secure, democratic Jewish state. So tonight I want to speak about four of the goals that our countries must pursue together to make that happen in a new Middle East. First, Iranian-made missiles and rockets launched from Gaza at Tel Aviv and Jerusalem only drove home what we already know. America, Israel, and the entire international community must prevent Iran from acquiring a nuclear weapon. This is a commitment that President Obama has made and repeated because we know very well the Iranian regime already exports terrorism, not only to Israel's doorstep, but across the world. If we had a map I could put up there, I could show you what we track and plot on that map. The evidence of terrorism, mostly, thankfully, plots foiled or unsuccessful, unfortunately, as in Bulgaria, some that succeeded. But those plots, those activities of Iran directly and through their agents stretches from Mexico to Thailand. We see Iran bringing repression to Syria. We see Iran brutalizing their own people. So a nuclear Iran is not simply a threat to Israel. It is a threat to all nations and risks opening the floodgates on nuclear proliferation around the world. When it comes to Iran's nuclear threat, the United States does not have a policy of containment. We have a policy of prevention, built on the dual tracks of pressure and engagement, while keeping all options on the table. The United States is ratcheting up the pressure to sharpen the choices facing Iran's leadership. We've had our own sanctions in place for many years, but we never had a coalition like the one we have built over the last 4 years. We convinced all 27 nations of the European Union to stop importing Iranian oil. And all 20 major global importers of Iranian oil, including Japan, India, China, and Turkey, to make significant cuts. Iran today exports more than 1 million fewer barrels of crude each day than it did just last year. Iran's currency is worth less than half of what it was last November. The pressure is real and it is growing. And let me add, we take pride in the coalition we have assembled, but no pleasure in the hardship that Iran's choices have caused its own people to endure. We are making every effort to ensure that sanctions don't deprive Iranians of food, medicines, and other humanitarian goods. I travel the world working to help people everywhere take part in the global economy. And we never lose sight of the fact that Iranians deserve this no less than any other people. America's goal is to change the Iranian leadership's calculus. We have worked with the P5 plus one to put a credible offer on the table. If there is a viable diplomatic deal to be had, we will pursue it. And should Iran finally be ready to engage in serious negotiations, we are ready. When Iran is prepared to take confidence-building measures that are verifiable, we are prepared to reciprocate. What we will not do is talk indefinitely. The window for negotiation will not stay open forever. President Obama has made that clear, and by now I think it should be clear. This is a president who does not bluff. He says what he means, and he means what he says. The second shared goal I want to discuss is this. Now that rocket fire from Gaza has stopped, America and Israel have to work together with partners in the region to turn the ceasefire into a lasting calm. Now, we have no illusions about those who launched the rockets. They had every intention of hiding behind civilians in Gaza and killing civilians in Israel. And they would have killed more of each if they could have. They even fired poorly aimed rockets at Jerusalem, endangering Palestinians as well as Israelis, Muslim holy sites as well as those of Christians and Jews. As we said throughout the crisis, Israel retains every right to defend itself against such attacks. But a lasting ceasefire is essential for the people of Israel, whose communities lie in the path of these rockets. The people of Gaza deserve better, too. Half the Gaza population are under the age of 18. These children, who didn't choose where they were born, have now seen two military conflicts in the last 4 years. Like all children, our children, they deserve better. Just as Israel cannot accept the threat of rockets, none of us can be satisfied with a situation that condemns people on both sides to conflict every few years. Those who fire the rockets are responsible for the violence that follows. But everyone, all parties in the region, and people of good faith outside of the region have a role to play in keeping or making peace. Israel can keep working energetically with Egypt to implement the ceasefire to keep the rockets out, but also work to try to advance the needs of the people of Gaza. For its part, Egypt can use its unique relationship with Hamas and the other Palestinian factions in Gaza to make clear that it opposes provocation and escalation on its borders. And we look to Egypt to intensify its efforts to crack down on weapons smuggling from Libya and Sudan into Gaza. I am convinced that if more rockets are allowed to enter Gaza through the tunnels, that will certainly pave the way for more fighting again soon. We are ready to help and to support Egyptian efforts to bring security and economic development to the Sinai. Others who are close to Hamas and the other factions in Gaza, including Turkey and Qatar, can and should make clear that another violent confrontation is in no one's interests. Hamas itself, which has condemned those it rules to violence and misery, faces a choice between the future of Gaza and its fight with Israel. America has shown that we are willing to work with Islamists who reject violence and work toward real democracy. But we will never work with terrorists. Hamas knows what it needs to do if it wishes to reunite the Palestinians and rejoin the international community. It must reject violence, honor past agreements with Israel, and recognize Israel's right to exist. Of course, the most lasting solution to the stalemate in Gaza would be a comprehensive peace between Israel and all Palestinians, led by their legitimate representative, the Palestinian Authority. Which brings me to the third goal we must pursue together. At a time when violence commands attention, America and Israel must do better at demonstrating not just the costs of extremism, but the benefits of cooperation and coexistence. For example, we have to convince Palestinians that direct negotiations with Israel represent not just the best, but the only path to the independent state they deserve. America supports the goal of a Palestinian state living side by side in peace and security with Israel. But this week's vote at the UN won't bring Palestinians any closer to that goal. It may bring new challenges for the United Nations system and for Israel. But this week's vote should give all of us pause. All sides need to consider carefully the path ahead. Palestinian leaders need to ask themselves what unilateral action can really accomplish for their people. President Abbas took a step in the wrong direction this week. We opposed his resolution. But we also need to see that the Palestinian Authority in the West Bank still offers the most compelling alternative to rockets and permanent resistance. At a time when religious extremists claim to offer rewards in the hereafter, Israel needs to help those committed to peace deliver for their people in the here and now. The leaders of the West Bank, President Abbas and Prime Minister Fayyad, deserve credit for their real achievements on the ground. They made their streets safe again. They brought a measure of peace. They overhauled governing institutions. They have cooperated with Israel to help enhance Israel's security. And we have to be honest with ourselves that right now, all of this needs our political and economic support to be sustainable. It also needs a political horizon. So, particularly in light of today's announcement, let me reiterate that this administration, like previous administrations, has been very clear with Israel that these activities set back the cause of a negotiated peace. We all need to work together to find a path forward in negotiations that can finally deliver on a two-state solution. That must remain our goal. And if and when the parties are ready to enter into direct negotiations to solve the conflict, President Obama will be a full partner. Now, some will say that given the disappointments of the past and the uncertainties of today, now is not the time even to contemplate a return to serious negotiations. That it should be enough for Israel just to muddle through, dealing with whatever crisis arises. But the dynamics of ideology and religion, of technology and demography, conspire to make that impossible. Without progress toward peace, extremists will grow stronger, and moderates will be weakened and pushed away. Without peace, Israel will be forced to build ever more powerful defenses against ever more dangerous rockets. And without peace, the inexorable math of demographics will one day force Israelis to choose between preserving their democracy and remaining a Jewish homeland. A strong Israeli military is always essential. But no defense is perfect. And over the long run, nothing would do more to secure Israel's future as a Jewish democratic state than a comprehensive peace. And that leads me to my fourth goal. At a time when the Arab world is remaking itself right before our eyes, America and Israel have to work together to do what we can to ensure that democratic change brings the region closer to peace and security, not farther away. But there is no going back to the way things were. We are not naive about the risks these changes are bringing. And we recognize that for Israel, they hit close to home. And so, even as the United States supports democratic transitions in Egypt and Tunisia, in Libya and Yemen, we are also making clear that rights and freedoms come with responsibilities. All states must address threats arising from inside their borders, fight terrorism and extremism, and honor their international commitments. And working closely with them on these critical issues does not mean we seek a return to the old bargain. Honoring obligations abroad does not lessen the need for these governments to respect fundamental rights, build strong checks and balances, and seek inclusive dialogue at home. Egypt's recent declarations and the decision to hold a vote on the Constitution, despite social unrest and a lack of consensus across Egypt's political spectrum, raise concerns for the United States, the international community, and most importantly, for Egyptians. To redeem the promise of their revolution, Egypt will need a constitution that protects the rights of all, creates strong institutions, and reflects an inclusive process. Egypt will be strongest, and so will our partnership, if Egypt is democratic and united behind a common understanding of what democracy means. Democracy is not one election, one time. Democracy is respecting minority rights. Democracy is a free and independent media. Democracy is an independent judiciary. Democracy requires hard work, and it only begins, not ends, with elections. And let me add that the work of building consensus does not belong to new democracies alone. America will need broad-based support to end our impasse over our budget. Israel will need the same to solve your challenges. Next door, the Syrian people are fighting for their rights and freedoms. A violent struggle against a tyrant is unfolding so close to Israel you can see it from the hilltops of the Golan Heights. Instability in Syria threatens all of us. But the safest and best path forward for Syria and its neighbors is to help the opposition build on its current momentum and bring about a political transition within Syria. The United States is using humanitarian aid, non-lethal assistance to the opposition, intensive diplomatic engagement, working with the Syrian people to try to bring about that political transition. So there's a lot on our plates. And for me, this is a remarkable moment in history. If we were just to step back for a time and look at what is happening around the world. But it is also a time that is fraught with anxiety and insecurity, uncertainty and danger. So we need to strengthen our consultations and collaboration on all of the issues that we face together. And we need to support the men and women in our militaries, in our diplomacy, who represent the United States and Israel at every turn so well. There is a lot of hard work ahead of us. But for me, there is no doubt that working together, we are up to whatever task confronts us. Protecting Israel's future is not simply a question of policy for me, it's personal. I've talked with some of you I've known for a while about the first trip Bill and I took to Israel so many years ago, shortly after our daughter was born. And I have seen the great accomplishments, the pride of the desert blooming and the startups springing up. I've held hands with the victims of terrorism in their hospital rooms, visited a bombed out pizzeria in Jerusalem, walked along the fence near Gilo. And I know with all my heart how important it is that our relationship go from strength to strength. As I prepare to trade in my post as Secretary of State for a little more rest and relaxation, I look forward to returning to Israel as a private citizen on a commercial plane, walking the streets of the old city, sitting in a cafe in Tel Aviv, visiting the many Israelis and Palestinians I have gotten to know over the years. And of course, it is no state secret that I hope to become a grandmother someday. And one day I hope to take my grandchildren to visit Israel, to see this country that I care so much about. And when I do, I hope we will find a thriving Israel, secure and finally at peace alongside a Palestinian state, in a region where more people than ever before, men and women, have the opportunity to live up to their God-given potential. That and nothing less is the future we must never stop working to deliver. Thank you all very much.
That was Hillary Clinton speaking before the Saban Forum the evening of November 30th. Now you'll hear excerpts from the press conference earlier that day with their spokesperson, Victoria Nuland.
Thing went a little late, and the secretary's thing went a little late, but here we are. I have nothing at the top. I think the front bench are on their way, so go for it, second bench. Please, Nadia.
So I'll start with the UN. Many analysts are looking into the vote yesterday, and most agree that was a slap in the face, was a diplomatic defeat for the United States. Do you see it this way?
You and Matt colluded on that one. I think all of you saw the explanation of vote that Ambassador Susan Rice gave yesterday. You also saw the comments that the Secretary made following her remarks to the Foreign Policy magazine event yesterday. We consider this unfortunate. We consider it counterproductive. As we had been saying all week, you know, our concern is about whether it takes us any closer to a Palestinian state. Clearly, it doesn't. So that was why we voted the way we did.
No.
Well, sorry, just to follow up. The Israelis decided to build, 3,000 new units as a response to this decision. Why didn't you see the Israeli decision as a unilateral act that also will endanger the peace process?
Well, let me start by reiterating our longstanding position with regard to settlements and with regard to Jerusalem. This is also not new. We reiterate our longstanding opposition to settlement activity and East Jerusalem construction and announcements. We also believe that these actions are counterproductive and make it harder to resume direct negotiations or achieve a two-state solution. Direct negotiations remain the only way to achieve the goal that both Palestinians and Israelis say they seek. So we're going to be even-handed in our concern about any actions that are provocative, any actions that make it harder to get these two parties back to the table.
So what will be the repercussions for the Israelis as a result of this?
Well, again, we are, as Ambassador Rice said yesterday, as the Secretary said yesterday, as we said at this podium, we're going to continue our efforts to try to get these parties to the table, because that's the only way that we are going to get to two states for two peoples with a sovereign, viable, and independent Palestine, living side by side in peace and security with a Jewish and democratic Israel. That's the goal that both parties say they want. The only way to get there leads through Ramallah and Jerusalem, not through New York, and we're going to keep trying, we're going to keep doing our best. But the parties have to want it, the parties have to work for it.
What is new about that announcement, it seems, in Jerusalem, is that the Israeli Prime Minister's office is asking for the expedition of final approval of building in E1, that crucial area outside East Jerusalem. Is that your understanding? I mean, that's something the Bush administration warned the Israelis against, advancing plans to build there. And I think the Obama administration reportedly did so a week ago. Is it your understanding?
Who you are?
Sorry, Dominic Waghorn, Sky News.
Our policy is, as I stated it, with regard to settlements and with regard to East Jerusalem. Our concern remains wherever this is and however it is.
Is it your understanding that they are expediting final planning for E1? Because that would be quite a significant move if they were, wouldn't it?
It sounds like that's a question for the Israelis, not for us, in terms of the specifics. I apologize to the front bench that we had a little bit of discombobulation this morning. We frankly didn't appreciate that the press conference that there was a little bit later than we had planned it.
The logistics of it afterwards seems a bit unusual.
Yeah, it was. And we got caught unaware ourselves, so apologies.
Since we have no idea actually what you were, what you've been saying for the last, 10 minutes?
We started about 3.5 minutes ago. Obviously addressed the settlement question. We addressed and repeated some of the statements made by Ambassador Rice and by Secretary Clinton last night with regard to the vote.
Okay. With regard to the vote, are you happy and satisfied with the support that you got?
I don't think we're going to go backwards on the vote.
Considering you wouldn't go forward on the vote before it happened, and you said that you would be willing to talk about it once it was over, I'm curious to know if you think that the support of 8 other countries against a huge number of other 138 countries, is that a success for U.S. diplomacy?
Again, I'm not going to characterize this in any way other than to say that the whole exercise, as the Secretary said yesterday, was unfortunate and doesn't take us any closer to a Palestinian state.
Does anything happen to countries that did not vote your way?
You mean, are we looking for...
Well, the Secretary in one of her speeches yesterday, she mentioned that someone had said to her, I look at your travel schedule and I can't imagine, why would you go to Togo? And she said, Togo is on the UN Security Council. Did the visit pay off in this way? I mean, Togo either abstained or voted yes. So I'd just like to know if there are consequences for countries that were lobbied, that you lobbied hard, that didn't vote the way you wanted, yesterday.
Matt, we had disagreements with a number of countries on this issue. That doesn't change our principled stand with regard to whether this was an effective way to help the Palestinians. We don't think it was.
Okay, with a number of countries is a bit of an underestimate. I mean, if you add 138 and 41, you had disagreements with 179 other countries.
Look, the vote is obviously clear.
Well, right, but I'm just wondering, and I'm going to go back to the question that I asked the last 2 days, is doesn't this ever give anybody any pause that you might be, that your principled stance isn't seen as a principled stance by the rest of the world, it's seen as an obstacle. Doesn't anyone ever... Why does the United States think that it has the moral high ground and the rest of the world doesn't on this when the rest of the world disagrees with you? I just don't understand how you can't take votes like this and the Cuba embargo vote, whatever, and just reflect on what it means.
Was there a question in there?
Yes.
This is why a speech rather than a question.
No. Here. Why can't you look at a vote like this, not you personally, but why can't the administration or the foreign policy apparatus look at a vote like this and instead of saying, we stuck by the moral high ground and we're right and everyone else is wrong, why can't you incorporate this with the message that was sent yesterday into your policy?
Matt, we are looking for an objective outcome that changes the future for the Palestinian people. This does not do that and effectively potentially makes a better outcome for the Palestinian people harder. As Susan Rice put it yesterday in her explanation of vote, you know, the grand pronouncements, the pressing of the green button is going to fade, and the Palestinian people are going to wake up and find that their lives haven't changed at all. The United States has made a commitment to both parties, is expected by countries around the world to try to advance the peace process. That's what we've tried to do for decades. Okay. That's what we will continue to do, what the president has pledged to do. And no matter what the action is, if it makes that goal harder, we're going to oppose it, and it certainly did in this case, okay. undercuts the way Israel is seen by the world.
Okay, so quite apart from the other countries, what about the Palestinians? Are there any consequences for them from the United States for them having gone ahead with this?
Well, as we have said all week here, there is nothing in legislation that's automatically triggered if you're asking about the legal consequences for this.
I'm also asking political consequences. I mean,
I think that obviously is a question at the moment better directed at the Congress than at us. You've seen a number of initiatives that have been proposed there. And as we have said for some time, we still have some $495 million in fiscal year 2012 funds that we're trying to encourage the Congress to release for the Palestinians.
So you're still trying to do that.
You're
not now less interested in resuming the negotiations.
So our
policy-wise, there isn't any impact from the administration's point of view on the Palestinians for pursuing this.
We've said all along that we will, as an administration, the president's made clear, continue to try to work for the outcome that we seek, and we will also continue to try to support the Palestinian Authority because this money supports their ability to administer the territories, provide security, and take care of the needs of the Palestinian people who we continue to believe need our support, need the international community's support. But the degree to which people are looking to the United States to try to help the peace process, we're discouraging of any efforts that make that harder.
Okay, and then I'll stop after this, but just tangentially related to the settlement, the announcement of the new construction, that is something that actually does have an impact the day after, the years after. It is not a grand pronouncement. It is not pushing a button which fades. It is something that has a very real impact on the ground. You're saying that there are not going to be any policy consequences, at least from the administration, maybe from Congress, but from your point of view, from the administration's point of view, there aren't any consequences for the Palestinians in going after this vote. But on something, will there be any consequences for Israel going ahead with this kind of settlement activity, which actually does have an impact on a potential peace negotiations?
Well, you missed before you came in that I said again here, as we have always said with regard to this, our longstanding opposition remains to settlement activity and to East Jerusalem construction and to these kinds of announcements. Just as we said with regard to the New York action, we think this kind of move is counterproductive. It makes negotiations harder. But we also said that in the context of the move in New York, you had a risk of action causing reaction. So, you know, in the context of this, we're going to be even-handed in saying we don't want to see provocative action. Instead, we want to see the parties focused on coming back to the table without preconditions.
But you're also going to be even-handed in not applying any penalty to either side for doing things that you think are bad for the peace process, right?
Our commitment is to continue to try to improve this environment. That has not always been easy, as the last couple of weeks demonstrate, but we're going to keep trying.
And I apologize if this is already out there, but has there been any communication between this building and senior members of the Palestinian Authority since the vote? I think particularly Prime Minister Fayyad's in town now. Is there any plan to meet with him? How are you going to take it forward with them?
I spoke to David Hale this morning. He said that he has been in phone contact with the Palestinians, specifically with his counterpart, Mr. Arakat, since the vote. But I don't have anything to announce, Andy, with regard to meetings beyond that.
It's on Secretary's schedule, but she's going to
Well, obviously, forgive me, I had forgotten that. Obviously, she's going to see at the Saban Forum, she's going to have a number of short pull-asides with various participants in those meetings, including Mr. Fayyad. Sorry about that, I had forgotten that.
In terms of those meetings, maybe you don't know, but do you expect her to ask them how they see things going ahead, or do you expect her to knock heads together? I mean, both sides have now done things that you don't think are good. What is the context of, what is she going to say to them? Is she going to say, hey, guys, we really need to try and salvage something here? Or is she just going to say, wag her finger at both of them and walk away?
The Secretary of State doesn't wag her finger. That's not
I've seen her do it.
She may wag her finger at you, Matt. I don't know.
Shake her fist.
Finger wagging, not in her repertoire. But, obviously she's going to take soundings with the various folks that she sees at Saban tonight as to how they see things moving forward and how they see the situation. If we have anything to read out from those meetings, we certainly will. Kim.
You say that the move at the UN was not helpful, doesn't bring the parties closer to a solution, but clearly nothing else is. I mean, you've been trying for 4 years to get them to the negotiating table. Why not give the Palestinians a bit of symbolic hope? I mean, why not cheer them on for that?
Again, it doesn't, Kim, change a thing about the lives of the Palestinian people, and our goal has been to help them get to the state that they want and they deserve, and if this makes the environment more difficult, we considered it a bad move, and we've been saying that.
And if the Israelis do remove the last remaining planning obstacle to building on the last bit of empty land between the West Bank and East Jerusalem, E1, which is what they've said they are expediting today, it's a question for the Israelis, you're saying? Will there be consequences from the US if that happens?
Again, you're taking me into hypothetical situations that we haven't seen yet.
An Israeli prime minister spokesman today has said that they will expedite planning procedures for E1.
Again, we've made our comment here about settlements in line with our longstanding policy. I don't have anything else to predict with regard to our policy. Kim?
Sorry, can I just follow up? I know this has been, the subject of the week, if not the subject du jour.
Yes.
But I still find it puzzling because, as you said, the move by the Palestinians at the UN doesn't actually change anything on the ground. You say it doesn't make it's not helpful, but it's only not helpful in the eyes of the Israelis. They're the ones who don't want it, whereas they are actually taking action on the ground that is changing the way any Palestinian state might look in the future, potentially making it impossible. So why is the U.S., in essence, making it possible for the Israelis to continue with their agenda and not helping the Palestinians in any sort of way? The Palestinians are always the ones who are having to cave in to the pressure.
We have for arguably decades, but certainly years and months, been working with both sides to try to get this administration has to try to get them back to the table directly without preconditions. That's the only way you're going to get a real negotiation going, which is going to get you closer to a state. The degree to which any of these actions are seen as provocative by the other side, they make the environment harder, they take you further from that actual move that's going to make the difference in terms of getting to two states. That's why we oppose it, Kim. I don't think it's a very big mystery. We've been pretty clear about it all year, all month, all decade.
Does your support or your rejection of the move by the Palestinians at the UN give you more leverage on the Israelis now to push them towards the table?
It's not a matter of that. It's a matter of trying. You have to create the environment, you have to support an environment where both sides see advantage to coming to the table. Every time there is provocative action on one side or the other, that makes that harder. All right, can we move on, please?
Yeah. It's not controversial, I don't think, on this. And that is, did the Israelis tell you that they were going to go ahead with this announcement this morning if the Palestinian vote went ahead and succeeded?
To my knowledge, we didn't have any specific advanced notice of what actions they might take. They generally do not consult us on these things before they do them.
But they told you that they would be responding in some way.
They made clear publicly that they would respond. I don't think that's a particular surprise.
But did you say you don't think that that's a good idea?
We
should just
always
take your lumps and
we always caution against settlement activity. We
no,
always
no, no, no.
Do.
I mean, any kind of tit for tat response, because it forgive the expression, it appears to be kind of childish. This going back and forth, I'm going to hit you, so or you hit me, so I'm going to hit you back, kind of thing, which is not the way, as you know, to get to peace talks or anything else. So I just, did you tell the Israelis, look, this is a foregone conclusion. We're going to lose this vote, and we're going to lose it by a lot. Please don't overreact. Was there anything like that?
Matt, beyond telling you that we have been clear about our longstanding position on all of these issues with the parties, I'm not going to put you in the room in our negotiations with them or with the Palestinians before this. I'm sorry.
What you just heard were excerpts from a press conference held November 30th at the State Department by Secretary of State Clinton's press spokesperson, Victoria Nuland, preceded by a speech by Clinton to the Saban Forum that evening in Washington, D.C. A lot can happen in 4 years, but for the moment it appears that Israel's hold over Washington will be safe in her hands.